already seated, and that is so exceedingly rare. It's like a blue moon. We're going to go ahead and get started. But I wanted to welcome you here before I forget my manners. Welcome you here. If you'll turn to Acts 21, that's where we'll be eventually. It was some years ago. You know, it may have been 2011, probably 2012. I spoke at the Freed Hardeman Lectureship. And I don't want you to get the wrong idea. You know, like they put the important speakers. If you're important, they put you in Lloyd Auditorium. Lloyd Auditorium holds a couple thousand. I think it's also nicknamed Allen Webster Auditorium. That's where Allen speaks when he goes, is at Lloyd Auditorium. I've only walked by there, seen it from a distance, like the pilgrims in Hebrews 11. I saw it from afar, just strangers and pilgrims. They had me in what I think was a college dormitory closet. I had to step over some kid's socks and stereo to get to the podium, but I was the second one to speak that day. And there was a guy, a man, who spoke before me. And I looked up because he had his PowerPoint presentation. And I happened to catch it before they put it in slideshow view. You can look in the lower left hand and see how many slides they're going to have. And this sounds like I'm making this up because it sounds like a number I would just pull out of the air. I'm not. He had 136 slides. 136. And so that just depressed me right out of the gate, put me in a little bit of an ill mood if I was telling the truth. I just texted Amanda and said, "Gonna be here a while. Gonna be here a while." Because there ought never to be in the hit. I could do a day-by-day account of Methuselah's life in less than 136 slides. Somehow, I would do it. 130, what? What are you doing? Well, that's not what. And I tell the kids at school, you know, they do a PowerPoint presentation. I don't want you to go to Wikipedia and copy and paste large blocks of text and put them in your presentation and then get up and read them to me. This is no offense to kids everywhere, but most kids' presentations stink. I mean, they do. And you don't tell them that, maybe nicely. Wow, that was almost good. You know, you can't really tell them that because that hurts their feelings and stuff. You get fired for that kind of stuff. But they get up there and what do they do? What all kids do, they read it. They read what's on the screen. And then he said, I tell them, don't do that. Don't read it to me. Even adults do that too. Because I've been in faculty meetings before, and they'll have this is important, everybody eyes up here, and then they'll just read, they'll have it on the screen, and then they'll read it. They'll read it, and I can read. You could have emailed me that, and it could have saved us all a lot of time. Well, I tell the kids this, you know, they say you know something when you can take it and put it in your own words. That's what I said, all that to say, that one sentence right there. You know that if you're having to read it, especially verbatim, you don't know it yet. You haven't internalized it yet. You know it when you can take it and just share it. And so having said that, this is what I wanted to ask you. What in the world is Acts chapter 21 about? Did y'all read Acts 21? We're at church, so I can't ask you. Just tell me a story and tell me you read it. That's not how you do it. Did you read Acts 21? Well, what was it about if you had to put it in your own words? That doesn't count. You see that on the screen. I wrote down in my notes, and this, if I had to give a subtitle to this chapter, I wrote down, "No Good Deed Goes Unpunished." And that's not fair, and we'll talk about it, because what's Paul doing this whole time? He's going to Jerusalem. And what's he doing? He's taking a contribution to the churches, from the Gentile churches that he had helped establish. And according to Acts 20, verse 4, I think it is, he's got seven men with him. Seven men plus Paul plus Luke. So there's nine of them going to Jerusalem, right, with this contribution. And once he gets there, not much good happens. I mean, he's falsely accused, or he's what they say that he's teaching is not really what he's teaching. There's a confusing situation that I don't know we can fully understand. And then after that, it goes from bad to worse. Then he's accused of doing something he didn't do based on hearsay. They assume that he had brought a Gentile into the temple, and he hadn't. Paul wouldn't have done that. And so then they almost kill him. And so, and all the while, what's he trying to do? Take them a donation. Take them a donation. You think after a while, Paul might get discouraged. You know, he's just trying to do what's right. So I want to look at this chapter, but I just wanted to see if we could just sort of put it in our own words, what's happening. Because as we get closer, this narrative is speeding up, and everything that happens in the rest of the book now is because of what happens tonight, because of what happens in chapter 21. Now, Paul, at the end of 20, he's in Miletus with the Ephesian elders, and he leaves Ephesus. It's time to go. He's been there 3 years. And Luke, as the chapter opens, starts to recount their voyage from Miletus to Jerusalem. They don't go all at once. That's 400 miles to the southeast. And it's speeding up because there's a storm brewing, metaphorically speaking, the closer Paul gets to Jerusalem. They get to Tyre, and I won't spend much time on the first few verses. But when they come to Tyre, and they say they pass Cyprus on their left, past that island, they're going to Tyre. Paul finds a group of disciples, stays with them a week, and they tell him through inspiration what's going to happen to him. They warn him what's going to happen in Jerusalem. And then of their own volition, they put their two cents in and they urge him not to go. Holy Spirit didn't tell Paul not to go to Jerusalem because Paul wouldn't have went if he had. They said that, you know, we know this is what's going to happen, and our judgment is you shouldn't go. But Paul was not going to be deterred. And so they visited for a week, I think it was, and then they reboard the ship, same ship that they came in on, and they make it to Caesarea. All right, and at Caesarea, they go to the home of Philip the evangelist. This was Philip back from Acts 6. Remember, one of the seven servants or deacons that was helping with those Greek widows. And he's called the evangelist, perhaps to separate him, to distinguish him from the apostle. Remember, Jesus called them one by one, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. Next came Philip. That's not this one. This is Philip, the traveling preacher, sharing the gospel. And Philip said he has four unmarried daughters, four virgin daughters, who prophesied. That was one of the nine spiritual gifts in the early church, 1 Corinthians 12, 8 through 10. But to one is given this gift, to another is given that gift, the gift of knowledge, the gift of miracles, tongues, the interpretation of tongues. They had the gift of prophecy that was likely given by the laying on of Paul's hands. Now, that doesn't mean they were out preaching to mixed audiences, right? That would have been inconsistent with the gift, with God's intention for it. They used it, obviously, consistent in harmony with their role. Now, this is interesting to me. Somebody suggested that, you know, they stay here for a few days with Philip, and maybe this is where Luke got his information about Philip's activities. It was from interviewing Philip during this time. So, Philip, what have you been up to? And Philip tells him, oh, you know, it's been interesting. And he tells him about the conversion of the Ethiopian eunuch, that Luke is writing this down, and this becomes Acts chapter 8. Well, while they're staying with Philip, a prophet comes down. We've seen him before in chapter 11. He came down from Judea because you're going downhill. Name was what? Agabus. And Agabus takes Paul's belt, and what's he do with it? Yeah, he takes the belt from around Paul's waist and he binds his own hands, right, feet. And it's an object lesson, straight out of the Old Testament. Ezekiel couldn't have been any prouder, right? He's acting out this lesson that this is what's going to happen to you, Paul, once you get to Jerusalem. They're going to bind your hands. You're going to face persecution, and the Jews are going to deliver you over into the hands of the Romans. And this is the third time now, not once, not twice. This is the third time that Paul has been warned that trouble is lurking for you in Jerusalem. Just prepare yourself, steel yourself, because you're going to face difficult times. And what was the brethren's reaction when they heard this prophecy of Agabus? They want Paul to go or not. They begged him not to go. Right? They were terrified for him. Please don't go. They urged him not to go. They loved him. They were human. Right? And Paul says, what do you mean? Weeping. You're going to break my heart. Right? You're breaking my heart. He says, I'm ready not only to be bound. You know, this prophecy that Agabus bound himself. I'm ready not only to be bound in Jerusalem or imprisoned in Jerusalem. I'm ready to what? I'll die there. I'll die there for the name of Jesus Christ if I need to. Well, this is so true to life, isn't it? They don't go. No, he's on a divine mission, right? He's going there to convey this gift. And even though he's got this money for these poor brethren, they say, we don't want you to go because we don't want anything bad to happen to you. They loved him, right? And they pleaded with him, don't go. But they couldn't talk him out of it. And Luke writes, when we saw, essentially, I'm paraphrasing obviously, but when we saw that we couldn't change his mind, when we saw that we couldn't deter him, they said they would leave it in the Lord's hands, his will be done. Isn't that, you know, do you ever, we pray and it just becomes something rote in our prayers. We pray these things if they be thy will, pray these things according to thy will. And it just becomes something almost, if we're not careful, that it's just a cliche that we pray and not thinking about what we're praying. And Wayne Jackson has a note in his commentary that a lot of us are, we're only willing for the Lord's will to be done when it is apparent we're finally satisfied that ours won't be. You know, what ought to be our prayer from the word go, right? William Barclay said that at the end, the perfect prayer is simply, thy will be done. Because that's the perfect prayer. May your will, Lord, be done. You know the end from the beginning. You're already in the future. You know all things. You know what's best for me. And whatever happens to me ultimately is what's best for me because you're going to work it out if I'll stay faithful. God's not unfaithful. He doesn't do things arbitrarily. But that's not how we are, is it? You think about something you've really wanted. You've really, or not wanted, whatever the case is. And you prayed about it. Well, how did you go to God in prayer? Lord, here's the situation. And all I want, Lord, is what is best. So whatever that is, if it goes for me or it goes again me, I just want your will to be done. Is that how we pray? That's to your credit if it is. Don't we try to state our case? Look, this is what I want. This is what I want. Don't let this happen, Lord. I want this, or don't let this. And then we finally see what's going to happen. Well, the Lord's will be done. The Lord's will be done. As if, you know, God doesn't know what he's doing. Now, here we go. Verses 15 and 16. After some time, Luke says, the missionary team took their baggage and went up to Jerusalem. The King James here says took up their carriages. That's an obsolete term. It meant what it meant in the 17th or 16th century, but it could convey a wrong meaning today. A carriage here, you know, they didn't get in the buggy. You know, a carriage here is not something that carries a man, but it's something that a man carries. It's luggage. It's baggage. And several of the disciples from Caesarea accompanied them, one of whom was... I was hoping y'all would say his name. I just want to hear how you said it, because I don't know how to say it either. You're not going to say it? Manason? I would just say Nason, because I don't say Kanaf. For some reason, I think that M is silent. I don't think it's doing any work, but that's, you know, I say Nason, tomato, tomato. And he's called, and it depends on what version you're reading from. The King James calls him an old disciple. Just this old man decided he'd... The ASV has an early disciple. And he may have been old, but that's not what the word old there means, right? The King James. It has nothing to do with age. It means he was one of the first disciples, probably tracing his lineage back all the way to the day of Pentecost. So it has to do with he was a disciple from the beginning, an early disciple, not necessarily this old man came along with us. And we don't know anything else about him, but, and it's almost like we're being rude, he may have been kind of well-to-do. You know, why do I say that? They stayed with him, and how many did they have? at least, I mean, I don't know how many they had, because some from Caesarea accompanied them, but I know before they even picked up the stragglers, so to say, how many did they have? Had nine, had those seven men from Acts 20, right, and had Paul and had Luke, that's eight, nine, Nason, they stayed in his house with some from Caesarea. So he must have had pretty nice quarters, unless he just put them up on the roof, and I don't know that Nason would do that to him. But think about this, the fact that these brothers were willing, we think about Paul's courage, and he was courageous, but the fact that these brethren from Caesarea were willing to go along with Paul, knowing what was going to happen, that says something about their courage too, doesn't it? And something about the power of Paul's example. Something about Paul's example. It reminds me a little bit, was it Thomas that said, let's talk about what Jesus, well, let's go with him, we'll die too. You know, like they were resigned to it. Now here we go. I'm already to verse 17. Finally, Paul and his men arrive in Jerusalem. And you know, it goes good at first. You know, Paul says that the brethren received him gladly. And Paul does what he does. He recounts how God has blessed his ministry, how he has worked among the Gentiles, and he goes point by point and shares with them all the things that God has done. The attention's not on Paul, but on what God has done through him. And they rejoiced. They rejoiced in that. Well, the next day, there's that special meeting. And I picture it being at James's house. The missionary team was there. So Luke is there, Paul is there, and those that accompanied them. The Lord's half-brother James is there. James was a very influential figure in the Jerusalem church. Again, he's Jesus' half-brother. He describes himself as a servant in the book that bears his name. And the Jerusalem elders were there. All right, so we've got, this is an important meeting, right? And Paul starts out, like I said, rehearsing his labors. Thank you, Paul. We're excited about that. But you know they've got something they're waiting to tell him. You ever had, you know, you want to tell somebody something and they're talking to you and you're waiting on them? Paul, we got something we got to talk to you about. Well, what is it? Well, this is a problem that they felt was serious. And I'll tell you this, this next section is, in my judgment, the most challenging episode in the entire book. The most challenging episode in the whole book. They said, okay, Paul, here's the problem. You know that there are thousands of those among the Jews, thousands of Jews who have obeyed the gospel. And they've become Christians. But, if I can interpret or paraphrase, they've yet to fully realize that the law of Moses has been nailed to the cross. And so they're still practicing some of the customs and the ceremonies affiliated with the law of Moses. Alan preached on Sunday, the law of Moses was nailed to the cross, and of course it was, Colossians 2:14. It was nailed to the cross, but like Alan said, they didn't see it nailed. So they didn't immediately perceive that it was nailed, did they? It took time. This was an interesting transitional period, because you think, 1,500 years, the law of Moses has been the law of the land, spiritually speaking, and now all of a sudden, you know, it's been nailed to the cross. Did people immediately perceive that? No, of course they didn't. No more than we would have. Can you imagine for 1,500 years? Of course, we didn't live that entire time. But we've lived under a particular law for over a millennium and a half, and all of a sudden it's changed. What's going to be our natural tendency, right? We're as tradition-bound as any. And we're going to still hold to some of those traditions, and we're going to probably be suspect of people that are quick to break from it. What are they doing? That's just how we are, right? And so that's how some of the brethren were. They said, Paul, they see, you know, and this is, to me is looking around verse 24. Here was the problem, Paul. A report is circulating that you're going about teaching the Jews, and especially the Jews who live in Gentile lands. Now remember, you know, as far as Gentiles go, they'd already addressed that back in chapter 15. Do Gentiles have to keep the law of Moses? No. We met at the Jerusalem conference, right? We wrote that letter, and it said, they don't have to worry. Why would we put a burden on them that we nor our fathers are able to bear, but tell them to abstain from fornication, from things strangled, from blood, from idolatry, and if you do these things, you'll fare well. But what about the Jews? That was for the Gentiles. You know, what about the Jews? They weren't as quick to perceive that the same truths that apply to those Gentiles apply to us, right? it didn't seem to enter their minds. Well, no, of course, we're still under the law. We're still under certain tenets of the law. And Paul, this is what's, you know, all these Jews have obeyed the gospel, and what they've heard is, this report is circulating, that you're teaching them, the Jews who live in Gentile lands, that they can just forsake the law of Moses. Well, you know, yeah, right? As far as, were they under the law? And Brother Jackson points out in his commentary, it's probably true that James and the elders here probably didn't fully appreciate what Paul was teaching themselves. Right? They say, well, is this what you're teaching them? This, and you know what they say, perception is reality. If this is what people think that you're teaching, Paul, to them, it is. And we need to remedy that. We need you to do something. Now, here's the thing. They thought that Paul opposed any sort of connection whatsoever to the Mosaic Law. Was that true? Now, that really wasn't correct, was it? Because remember, Paul took Timothy, and what did he do? He circumcised him. That's chapter 16, verse 3. Not as a matter of salvation, but as a matter of expediency, so they could work more freely among the Jews. Well, Paul didn't oppose observing certain elements of the law of Moses, provided that the intent was not to secure salvation. Not trying to do it. I didn't have Timothy circumcised to save him. Paul opposed that, right? He opposed that. This was an expediency matter. But Paul was not insensitive to the feelings of his Jewish brethren, even though that had become his reputation. Now, here is the solution they proposed. And this is, you know, it's interesting. Look at verse, was it 24? Right. Then they'll know, if you do what we're proposing, they'll know that you walk orderly and you observe the law. But I don't observe the law. Well, this is what we want you to do. We've got four men who were under a vow, a Nazarite vow. And you remember that from the Old Testament? And their hair is going to grow long. They're not going to eat meat or drink strong drink for, was it 30 days? And then they're going to go to the temple at the end of that time. There's all these different offerings that they're going to make. And, of course, their hair is going to be cut. It's going to be offered there on the altar. It was an expensive vow, because there were a lot of different sacrifices, offerings that were made at the conclusion of that vow. And so oftentimes what would happen is the people that did it would look for some wealthy patron who would sponsor them to pay the fees for their sacrifices as they went to the temple. Well, what they suggested was, we want you to go and purify yourself with them in the temple. We want you to pay their temple fees and you purify yourself along with them. And this will show, I think this is 24, this will show that you are walking, and they'll see there's nothing to what they've heard about you, that you are walking orderly, that you're observing the law. And, you know, knowing Paul, you might think at first glance what he would say was, well, now I can't do that. That wouldn't be the right thing to do. Are you surprised to read that Paul agrees to what they say? And the next day, he went with those four men to the temple where the sacrifices would be offered. And the four men were purified, and so was Paul, though likely not for the same reason. They were being purified at the end of their Nazarite vow. There's no indication Paul was under a Nazarite vow, but he had been in Gentile lands, and so ceremonially, understand, he would have been considered unclean. Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem. Why would Paul, knowing that the law of Moses was nailed to the cross, why would Paul submit to a purification ritual, which would, on the surface, which would appear to suggest that Christ's blood was not enough, that Christ's blood was insufficient? Why would you offer a sacrifice, Paul? Paul, did you not know? You don't have to. Jesus is our sacrifice. Paul, why did you agree to this? And there are respected commentators who obviously differ on what happened. I'm going to give you three of the more common suggestions. The first one is that Paul did not fully, I'm just giving you the possibilities, right? Paul did not fully understand at this point that the law was abrogated. That he was still learning, he was still coming to terms with the fact, and he didn't fully himself understand the implications of what he did. So he sinned, but it was sinning through ignorance. That's option number one. Option number two, Paul knowingly sinned. In a moment of weakness, he knew it was wrong. He already knew the law was abrogated, but he knowingly sinned. He yielded to the pressure. He was human. And then the third option was that Paul's actions were a matter of expediency that were related to this very unique time period. Now, let's look at each one real quick. J.W. McGarvey held to the first view in his commentary in 1892, which would have been the second one, the updated one. McGarvey said that Paul's understanding was limited at this point. Well, why I can't, I will, you know, you, if you disagree, you know, sometimes people just throw around, well, I think Brother Woods was wrong on this, or I think, and they're like, who are you, Pipsqueak? You know what I mean? These are respected men, and so you don't disagree with McGarvey lightly, but when somebody else disagrees with him, you can agree with their disagreement. How about that? I think here's a good reason. I think that first reason is not correct. Paul had already penned the books of Romans and Galatians by the time this incident happened. Now, what's Romans 7 say? You're dead to the law, that you should be married to another. The whole illustration we talked about it Sunday, right? What's Galatians 5 say? He was talking to some that were trying to enforce circumcision, and he said, if you try to enforce circumcision, you're a debtor to the whole law. And you can't keep the whole law, and if you try to be justified by the law, you're severed from Christ. You're fallen from grace. So Paul had already argued. It wasn't like, you know, Peter on Pentecost made a passing statement that he didn't even fully appreciate. Remember, Peter said the promises to you and to your children and to all that are afar off, that's the Gentiles. But then 10 years later, it takes a miracle repeated three times for Peter to grasp, oh, the Gentiles, I can go into their house. It wasn't a fleeting instant like that. Paul is writing definitively, we're not under the law. And so I don't think option one will work. Option number two, Paul knowingly sinned. Well, it now, someone says, well, Peter, you remember Peter sinned and Paul had to withstand him to the faith. So the apostles, though inspired when they wrote, were not infallible when they lived. And that's true. That is true. But we ought to be really careful about accusing an apostle of sin without the strongest sort of evidence. Now, we know Peter did wrong, right? Well, if Paul sinned here, then who else also sinned? Because it's not just going to be Paul. Who else sinned? James and the Jerusalem elders. Because they're the ones that suggested it, right? Somebody says, well, they all sinned then. Well, now think about that. Think about who these men are. Now we're not just indicting Paul. We're indicting all of them as having sinned. Somebody says, well, that's possible. Well, okay, I will grant that. Here's the clincher for me. Right? I don't think Paul knowingly sinned here. If Paul sinned here, why did he later, in an inspired defense before a government official, Felix, why did Paul appeal to this very incident in support of his actions? Acts 24:17-18. You'll notice Paul stands before Felix and he says, Paul says, it wasn't more than it was a few days ago I was here in the temple and I was worshiping in the temple, and this is what he's talking about. Right? And somebody says, what convinces you that? Remember what Jesus promised them back in Matthew 10? When you stand before kings, you are not to take thought how or what you shall speak, for it shall be given you in that hour what you shall say, for it's not you that speak, but who? Who speaks? Holy Spirit. Now, did the Holy Spirit lead Paul to defend his sin? I think option two, I think the cure is worse than the disease. Paul didn't make an inspired defense of his sin. He didn't say, well, I did this, but it was wrong. He said, no, this is what I did. I don't think we can indict Paul here. Third view is Paul went through this ritual as a matter of expediency to relieve a tense situation. He purified himself, true, but he had no intention. It goes back to motive. He had no intention of substituting an animal sacrifice in the place of Christ. Think about this. if Paul could have Timothy circumcised as a matter of expediency, no intent, he still circumcised him, didn't he? Right? He still circumcised him. What made the difference? The motive, the intent. If Paul could do that, why could he not have done the same thing relative to a sacrifice? To offer a sacrifice redemptively would have been wrong. Would have been wrong. But there's no proof that was Paul's intention. I think, and there may be no view that's completely free of difficulty. But now think about this. He went through this purification ceremony. And here's a point I want to make to you. Going through a purification ceremony did not automatically mean that you were atoning or trying to atone for sin. Why do I say that? Remember after a woman gave birth, so many days she was considered ceremonially unclean, and then what did she have to go through? Purification. Purification. Because she's sinned? Childbirth sinful? No, it was a ceremonial uncleanness, right? And I would submit that that is what Paul did. Now, whatever reason these four men are offering their sacrifice, I don't know. I don't think Paul was doing it for the same reason they were. This was something Paul could say, I'm doing this to try to help with some Jew and Gentile relations. And it's not an ideal situation, and I would have to almost have to imagine Paul could think, oh, I could wish I didn't have to do this. It didn't violate his conscience, though, or why do I say that? Or would have done it. Acts 23, right? He wouldn't have done it if it violated his conscience. So, like I said, in the absence of more information, I don't think it's good to accuse Paul of sin. There may have been a greater good involved than whatever negative impressions might have resulted. And this is what Brother Jackson says, and I think it's a good point. He says, if we're going to err, E-R-R, if we're going to make a mistake, if we're going to err in judging this episode, he said, let's err on the side of respect and love. And I think that's a good idea. I'm not prepared to indict Paul here for sin. Now, during this same time frame, Paul had frequented the temple complex because he had to go there to tell them in a few days this vow is going to be made. They had to prepare, make preparations for the completion of the vow. And so Paul had been in and out of the temple complex. Well, lo and behold, who always is a thorn in Paul's side? It's the Jews from a particular region, it seems, that were especially feisty, right, from Asia. And maybe they were from Ephesus. Remember, great is Diana of the Ephesians. And here they come again. Here are these Jews from Asia again. They saw him in the temple, and they instigated a riot. And notice what they say. Paul can't catch a break, can he? Because remember, when the Ephesians were complaining, they said, Demetrius said, this man preaches everywhere that there are no gods that be made with hands, so he's preaching against idolatry. Well, what did the Jews here say? They said he's an enemy of the Hebrew people. They said he's an enemy of the law of Moses, and he's an enemy of this holy place. Paul caught it from all sides. And they charged Paul. They said he has brought Greeks into the temple, and he's defiled it. Now, you see the large area there to the left? That was the court of the Gentiles. And so there was a place in the temple precincts where the Gentiles could go. But there was a boundary beyond which they could not pass. And what was it called? That middle wall of partition. Paul talks about the middle wall of partition that Christ broke down metaphorically. Well, and there you see this arrow. You can't appreciate the height. It was 4.5 feet tall, a stone wall. And it had an inscription. It was in Greek. And it was in Latin, and it said this, if anyone is taken in the act, if you're a Gentile and you go beyond this border, let him know that he has himself to blame for the penalty of death that follows. You got nobody to blame but you if you go beyond this boundary. Well, the Jews had seen Paul and Trophimus in the city. Trophimus was an Ephesian. Trophimus was a Gentile. They saw Paul and Trophimus in the city, and they suppose, well, he must have. We saw them together in the city. He must have brought them into the temple. That was an assumption. That was a supposition. And do you see how their accusation evolved? They saw them in the city. But that's not what they charged them with. The only thing they had proof of was we saw them in the city, but they charged them with being in the temple. And not only Trophimus, but what? Greeks, plural. Now, they only saw Paul with Trophimus. They said he's brought Greeks into the temple. Well, they didn't care about the truth anyway. And if that was true, if they had really seen Paul with Trophimus past that boundary wall, Paul could have crossed it, Trophimus couldn't have. Don't you know what they would have done? Would they not have seized Trophimus on the spot and any so-called Greeks that were there? Or at the very least, they would have reported them to the temple police so fast to make your head spin, but they didn't. What they did, this rumor spreads like wildfire, they seize Paul, they drag him out, and they're getting ready to kill him. Drag him out, they shut the doors, and they whip him. The doors between the court of the Gentiles and the sanctuary were slammed shut. William Barclay says this, and I read this, and I put it in my notes, and I got to thinking, well, I'll tell you in a minute. Barclay says, there was never a time when Paul was nearer death than this. I'm like, that could be true. Then I thought, well, that one time, they did stone him. They did stone him in Lystra, so I mean, that's a toss-up, you know, at 6-1. But this is what Barclay says. There was never a time Paul was closer to death, and it was the impartial justice of Rome that saved his life. And I put in my notes, that's partly true. That's partly true, because if you flip over to Romans 15:31, when Paul is writing, I've got this contribution to make to the Jerusalem saints, and I want you Roman brethren to pray for me that I'll be delivered from them that are disobedient in Judea. I want you to pray that God will deliver me from these stubborn people that I have to go amongst. Did God answer that prayer? Absolutely He did, right? And in a dramatic fashion, because just as they were about to kill Paul, a report reaches the captain, the Roman commander, and we learn a few chapters later his name's Claudius Lysias. During festival times, the Romans kept an extra watch on the temple, kept a watch on the Jews because they tended to get a little bit excited. Claudius was stationed here in the fortress of Antonia. It was at the northwest corner of the temple area. Well, when Lysias hears what's going on, he gathers a group of soldiers and they run down to assess the situation. Now, when the people see the soldiers coming, Claudius coming, what do? Yeah, they left off beating Paul. They backed off of that. Lysias, really for Paul's own good, puts him under arrest, and he secured him with two chains, one arm to each soldier, chained to two soldiers. And the captain kept asking, who are you and what have you done? But the crowd was, so he was asking the crowd, I think, at first, who is this man? What has he done? And some said one thing, some said another. And it was so loud, he couldn't even figure out what's going on. So he has to kind of get out of this loud situation. So they brought Paul into the soldiers' barracks until it could all be sorted out. What I would add to Barclay said it was the impartial justice of Rome that saved him. Well, indeed, but it was God's providence. This was God's way of protecting Paul. He had used Gallio, right, in Corinth. He used the town clerk in Ephesus, and now he uses these Roman soldiers here in Jerusalem. Because this ultimately gave Paul a chance to preach the gospel in places and to people he wouldn't have had a chance to otherwise. Now, getting down to the nitty-gritty. Paul is about to be brought into the barracks. He's been beaten. You know he's bruised. He's probably bloodied at this point. But Paul turns to Lysias and he says, can I have a word with you? May I speak with you? And Lysias is caught off guard because he wasn't expecting to hear, cultured Greek, the accents of cultured Greek coming from this rabble-rouser, as far as he's concerned, that this mob is trying to lynch. And so he's a little bit disarmed. He speaks Greek. He wasn't expecting that. And so he says, well then, are you the Egyptian? Aren't you the Egyptian then who led the rebellion? Sometime around the year 54, there was an Egyptian who led a band of desperate men, and he promised them, he led them out to the Mount of Olives, and he promised them that he could make the walls of the city fall down flat. Well, obviously, that didn't come to pass. Rome came down and squelched that little rebellion, whatever you want to call it, but the man himself had escaped. The Egyptian had escaped, and so Claudius says, are you the Egyptian then that led this band of men? Well, what's Paul saying? Paul says, I'm a Jew. Which shows what right out of the gate? hey, I had a right to be in the temple. I'm a Jew. And I am a citizen of no mean city, the King James, I think, no obscure city. I'm not from Egypt. I'm a citizen of Tarsus in Cilicia. So I'm not your Egyptian. I'm a Jew. And I had a right to be in the temple. And Lysias is so impressed with Paul that he grants him, this is amazing, he grants him, because he's under arrest, just drag him on in. What are you not saying a word? No, he grants him permission to address the crowd. And I'm going to tell you right here, it's just here that I'll never, and in many other areas, I'll never ever catch up to Paul in this regard or probably any others. You put yourself in his shoes. You've got a contribution. All you're trying to do is just help somebody, for crying out loud. No good deed goes unpunished, I said. And here I'm come to Jerusalem to help these poor brothers. And what are y'all doing to me? Well, you've beaten me. You want to kill me. And now they're dragging him away. What would you have been thinking? I'd have been thinking, if you think you're getting this money. I think, I'll give them the money, and then I'm getting out of here. I don't think this thought would have crossed my mind. You know what would be a good thing to stop and do right now? I'll just see if I can't get permission to. I'm just going to see if I can't share the gospel with them real quick. I mean, really? Would that have been your modus operandi? You know what I think? I'm going to share the gospel with them. I thought, I don't think I am. I don't want to, but now notice what he says. He says, and Barclay says this, nothing in all the New Testament so shows the force of Paul's personality as this silence. Because he raises his hand. I had a live action shot of this. Paul, several times it shows him raising his hand and making a gesture. And remember, they're loud and they're trying to, they're saying one thing while saying another. And Paul just says, and they all get quiet. And Barclay says, the very power of God was flowing through Paul at that time. I like what he said. Nothing so shows or evinces the power of Paul's personality than getting silence out of this mob that wanted to kill him. Well, Paul begins to speak using the native Hebrew tongue, probably Aramaic. And when this hush just falls, hey, he's speaking our language. It was can you just picture it? This hush. A very dramatic moment. And the chapter division here is an interesting one, to say an unfortunate one. Look at verse 40. It's like one of those TV shows you're growing up, it only can last an hour or 30 minutes. And when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, come back next week. What did he say? You'll have to, same bat time, same bat, tune in next week. What did he say? Chapter 22. But I said at the outset, and I'll leave you with this, I wanted to call this chapter No Good Deed Goes Unpunished. That's taking a negative view of things. Paul was doing good, and they did punish him for it. Paul is cut from a different cloth, and I think we're called to be from that same cloth, if you want to know the truth. We're not supposed to follow just Paul, but Jesus Christ, the ultimate example, who on the cross, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. So, no good deed goes unpunished. I don't like that. That's not good. I want to leave you with this. We were reading the book Wonder. The movie's out. The book is way better than the movie. It's about a little boy, fifth grade boy. He's got a genetic disorder. He's been homeschooled all his life. He goes to public school. Will he be accepted or not? And his teacher, Mr. Brown, writes a precept on the board each month. Every month there's a different little precept, little maxim, rule to live by, little moral. And this was Mr. Brown's precept for May, and it's actually John Wesley's rule. Remember John Wesley, the Protestant reformer? I want to leave you with this. I've got this written on my board at school, unless some mean kid erased it. Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as you ever can. I like that. And that's the attitude, and I have to remind myself. I walk into school in the morning, it's the first thing I see to my right when I walk in my room. I see the bubblegum wad that's left right immediately to the door, and then I see that on the board. Do all the good you can as long as you live. That's Acts 10:38. Jesus went about what? And isn't that what Paul's doing here? These people have beaten him. They wanted to kill him. And what's he want to do? Let me share the gospel with you. Boy, I've got some growing to do, don't I? I've got some improving to do. Lord, have mercy on me. I want to do better. This teaches me. It rebukes me. It instructs me. I thank you for being here tonight and studying Acts 21 together with me. We're dismissed.